It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. And today for Rob Ferret, you're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our On Congress segment with USA Today Congress and political editor Paul Singer. He'll fill us in on what's happening in Washington, D.C.
But first, we're talking about the latest in the John Doe investigation. Today, 27,000 emails were released to the public. The emails are from a convicted former aide to Governor Scott Walker.
The release is part of that probe dubbed the John Doe investigation. Prosecutors are trying to determine if Walker's aides were working on his 2010 gubernatorial campaign while working under him as Milwaukee County executive.
The release of these documents is getting national attention because many pundits consider Governor Walker to be a presidential contender in 2016. Democratic groups across the nation are drawing attention to the document dump. A spokesperson for the Democratic Governors Association wished reporters, quote, happy digging.
And here to discuss how this document release could have a ripple effect on the national scene is Elizabeth Titus. She's a political reporter for Politico. Elizabeth, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
And let's start with the basics. We've been following this story in Wisconsin, of course, but those who haven't been keeping up necessarily, what is the John Doe investigation?
Sure. Well, it was a probe that went on for about 3 years in Wisconsin and ended last year. It resulted in charges against six people who had connections in some way to Governor Scott Walker. And much of the investigation focused on whether Walker aides used their time on the clock working for the public in county government or whatnot to participate in political activity or to help political candidates run for office. And like I said, the probe was closed last year, but a court ordered that many, many emails from the investigation be released, and that's what happened today, which shed a lot of light on some of the people involved in Scott Walker's world.
And to be clear, that initial probe was not into Governor Walker himself. It was into staffers around him that were working on his campaign while they were actually employees of the Milwaukee County Executive's Office.
Right. Governor Walker has said that he never believed that he himself was a target of this investigation. And of course, he was not ever charged with any wrongdoing. But several people either close to him or who had contributed to his campaign, a variety of people, these six who were charged, did end up getting implicated in some of these issues.
So the latest news on these released emails just happening today is that they tie Governor Walker to the secret email system that was used in his county executive office, that there was this parallel system that was known about, but there's actually at least one email that they have found that shows that, appears to show that Governor Walker knew about this system, which he has denied. How do you think this will impact his national standing?
Well, this is certainly getting more attention today in Washington, D.C. and in the national political media than I've seen it receive at any previous point. Obviously, this has been a big topic in Wisconsin, but I think you are seeing it start to break through a little bit. And, you know, in New Jersey with Governor Chris Christie there fighting a traffic scandal, you can see how an investigation close to any governor or any prominent politician, especially one like Governor Walker, who might have 2016 hopes, how that can really distract them from their message, how that can keep the media focused on things other than the governor's agenda, how it can create a little bit of a circus atmosphere. And that makes it very, very difficult for anyone who might be looking to create a roadmap to run for president in 2016.
And we do want to point out that it's according to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporting that earlier this afternoon that at least one email has been found. But right now that's all we know. And you brought up Chris Christie and how he responded when there when evidence came out that he was aware of the traffic stoppages and things like that. Do you think because Chris Christie has just gone through this, another potential Republican candidate for president, now Scott Walker is facing potentially a similar situation, do you think it's going to get more or less attention because of the Christie situation?
Well, that's a great question. I think that folks paying attention to the next presidential race are certainly primed to hear about and learn about stories similar to Christie's because it has been such a revealing episode there in New Jersey. I don't know, you know, there are a number of factors that make New Jersey and Wisconsin different. There's not quite the media market saturation. There's not the proximity to D.C. and New York, where you have, you know, easy access to cable news shows and whatnot. But the Walker thing does seem to be breaking through. And I don't know to what extent he might be taking cues from Chris Christie or not about how to handle this, but for Democrats, national Democrats, it certainly makes for a very easy narrative. You know, here's one Republican governor, Chris Christie, fighting multiple investigations, and now here's Scott Walker. And, of course, Republican governors would insist that they're getting very good results in their states, and they would dispute that sort of notion of a pattern.
Does this situation make Wisconsin more interesting to people who watch politics on a national level, or, you know, does it make us look like we're, you know, just another bunch of kind of corrupt people? We just happen to be in the middle of the country instead of on one of the coasts.
Well, I think that's a great question, and time will tell. What I can say from covering, you know, the situation in New Jersey and from watching some of these things play out is that people get very interested, political junkies get very interested when there are documents they can hold and sift through and read, primary documents like the ones released today, and that seems to pique a lot of people's interest. And so if, you know, history is any indication there, I would say that people are definitely tuning into what's happening in Wisconsin. And of course, there was tons of attention back when the national attention back when the recall took place, that has since quieted down a bit. And there could be a bit of a revival happening here, but time will ultimately tell.
Well, we will certainly keep tabs on this issue, as we're sure that you will as well. Elizabeth, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you.
That was Elizabeth Titus, reporter for Politico. It's time now for our weekly look at Congress with USA Today's Congress and Politics editor, Paul Singer. You can find him here at this time every Wednesday.
The Congressional Budget Office released its prediction yesterday of what would happen to the American economy if the minimum wage was raised to $10.10 an hour.
Also, this past Monday marked the fifth anniversary of President Obama's 2009 stimulus bill, and members of Congress duked it out over what the legacy of that bill should be.
Paul, it's great to have you back with us.
Well, great to be here. Thanks.
So what did the Congressional Budget Office have to say about how that $10.10 an hour minimum wage hike could affect the economy?
Well, they said two things that caught a lot of attention. The first thing they said is that it could cost 500,000 jobs if you raise the minimum wage $10.10, because the cost of the workforce will simply require people to scale back their hiring. The other half of what they said is that it would increase the standard of living for people who are getting those wages, lifting something like 900,000 people out of poverty and raising the wages for, I think, like 16 million people. So, again, two sides of a coin. Needless to say, Republicans jumped on this notion that raising the minimum wage would cost 500,000 jobs. Democrats jumped on the notion that it would raise people out of poverty, and the fur began to fly immediately. Also sort of interesting that the White House, which, as you know, President Obama has called for an increase in the minimum wage, the White House held a conference call with reporters shortly after the CBO report was released to basically debunk it. Their argument is that CBO is using a wrong methodology, in effect. And that the impact on jobs would be much, much less because, oh, an increased minimum wage increases productivity and stops people from quitting their jobs and stuff like that. But it was really interesting to see the White House come out. Obviously, they're taking this very seriously and directly contradict the CBO report and say, no, they got it wrong.
Is that unusual that the White House would come out and comment on it?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, it's not unusual they would comment on it. I think what was sort of unusual was the they jumped pretty much immediately to the phones and called the reporters and said, let's go talk about this. I mean, it's clear they're taking it very, very seriously.
So it sounds like this is a story that we will likely see playing out as the election seasons unfold.
Yeah, well, you won't have to wait that long either. The Senate Democrats are expected to bring a minimum wage increase to the Senate floor. I think the target date now is early March. And they, as you were hinting at, they want to force Republicans to vote against a minimum wage increase. Whether or not it is good policy, good economic policy, I do not know. But I will tell you that I do know that it is generally good for the Democrats. They think it polls very, very well as a political point. And so they want to force the Republicans to vote no. Republicans, you know, by and large, argue that it is bad for jobs, it's bad for the economy, it's the wrong way to go. But they also are looking for ways to, address the problem and kind of defang this. You know, are there ways that we can do well with other kind of cuts, maybe with other sort of rollbacks of regulations? Is there anything we do to offset it, find another way to do it so that it's not as poisonous a political item for them?
Paul, any sense yet if this report looks to change the future prospects for a possible minimum wage increase one way or the other right now?
You know, it's hard to say. I'm not particularly optimistic it's going to pass anyhow, because getting almost anything through the House of Representatives at this point is impossible. That is to say, getting any of the Democratic priorities through the House of Representatives is almost impossible. I'm not sure this changes that. In fact, to some degree, it's given the Republicans ammunition to say, hey, 500,000 jobs lost if you raise this minimum wage, and that's not coming from us. That's coming from the independent analysis at the CBO.
And yet you said the Democrats are seeing this as a pretty popular topic, one that they think people want to see championed. Is that going to have any bearing?
Well, I mean, again, I this is one of those conversations. Policy and politics are different things. You know, you won't. I'm not convinced we're going to change policy this year, but that won't stop us from making a lot of political hay over it.
Okay. Well, still on the topic of the minimum wage, we haven't seen any movement on unemployment benefits related matter there. Where do those stand?
Yeah, there's going to be another attempt to get something done, I suppose, in the next couple of weeks. Again, Republicans are looking for some way to move on this. There have been some talks about a possibility of a deal. You know, the issue here is the Republicans have argued throughout that they're not opposed to extending unemployment benefits, by and large, as long as they're paid for somehow. There should be spending cuts to offset it. Otherwise, it just becomes more debt. And whether there is some way to figure that out is sort of the next question. Can you? One of the things they did just before they left was agreed to extend or to reinstate some pension benefits for military retirees. And they figured out a way to pay for that. So the Democrats are now going to come back and say, well, how come you're willing to pay for, to use this mechanism to pay for military pensions, but not for unemployment benefits? Doesn't that seem unfair? So you'll see more of that conversation coming up next week. And it's possible that something will happen. Again, I'm in general less and less enthusiastic about the ability of Congress to pass almost anything, but it's plausible.
Any idea where that particular issue stands on the to-do list right now?
Well, my sense is that next week that's not on the House's agenda. They're going to be taking up flood insurance, of all things. The Senate, I think, has taken up a couple of nominations. So it's certainly not, a Monday afternoon kind of thing. Unemployment and minimum wage, I think, will be first up in the Senate. I don't think they have anything they want to do on unemployment at the moment. So until we figure out whether the House has come up with some way to pass it, I'm not sure you're going to see any action in the immediate future.
Well, this past Monday, as we mentioned earlier, there's an interesting anniversary of sorts that happened, the fifth anniversary of President Obama's stimulus package. Members of Congress wanted to have their say on that and the legacy of it. What did you hear?
Well, again, a lot of it depends on where you sit, I guess. One of the first things that President Obama did was get past this $800 billion stimulus package. And the administration remains proud of that. They don't talk a lot about it anymore. Some of it's old news, but they remain proud of it. And their argument is it stemmed the bleeding in the economy. It is clear it did not have the kind of rapid turnaround they were hoping for. They were making predictions about immediate reductions in the unemployment rate and a quick turnaround, and that didn't happen. It took years for the unemployment rate to come down. So to some degree, they stopped talking about it. But now, 5 years later, they put out an announcement saying, look, we prevented a double-dip recession. The economy has improved, has bounced back. We're proud of that, and it was a landmark achievement. The Republicans said basically exactly the opposite, that the bill was, the stimulus bill was largely a waste, a giveaway to a bunch of Obama cronies. It went into a whole bunch of goofball projects, wind farms and stuff that didn't really have any economic viability, didn't create a whole lot of jobs in the United States. I think what has happened now over the 5 years, it's become less relevant. You know, I mean, I don't think anybody's going to be running on the stimulus bill in 2014, and certainly not in 2016. But it is an interesting window into what is your philosophy of government. Also, just might mention, USA Today had a nice story, we're proud of ourselves, on Monday, that the turns out there's been a whole bunch of investigations of fraud in that bill, but very, very, very little actual loss. Maybe $200 million worth of losses, which is not much.
What kind of losses are we talking about?
Well, people who, steered money to fake projects, people who applied for money to, you know, fund my other brother, Daryl Contracting Company, whatever it was. You know, these are basically fraud claims. When there's $800 billion on the table, invariably people try to line their pockets with it. And there's been about 1,500 fraud cases already pursued by the government and another 1,500 still pending. But ultimately, they're concluding that there's really only about $6 billion worth of the spending that they think was questioned, basically, which is a tiny fraction when you think about $800 billion worth. But there's a great quote from one of the Republicans. He says, okay, well, so you poured $800 million down the drain, sorry, $800 billion down the drain. Just because you didn't spill any doesn't mean it was still a good idea.
Well, interesting quote there. So, hearing all of these things involved with the stimulus package and its anniversary, the fifth anniversary, which was Monday, it doesn't seem like there's a resounding yay or nay on how well it worked, at least in Washington and Congress. But is there a sense in the general public how this panned out?
That's an interesting question. I have not seen recently, at least, any kind of polling that indicates that people really remember it. This is a funny thing about how our government works is that we get all excited about stuff in brief periods of time, and then we kind of forget, right? This is what I meant about it's not going to be a 2014 election issue, I don't think, because people just sort of forget that it happened. There are still people, obviously, who believe that the Obama philosophy of governing is wrong, right? It's spending too much, it's racking up too much debt, and this becomes part of that narrative. But I do think it is clear that the American people feel, and this has been shown in the polling, that the economy is getting better, that their situation is generally getting a little bit better, and that the country is moving towards the right direction. I think there is a lot of sense that it has been happening too slowly, and still a great deal of concern about debt and deficit and stuff like that. But in general, the economic signals have been pretty good, and I think that to the degree that picks up any speed from a political standpoint, that's good for the Democrats. If people feel like the economy is getting better, that's good for the incumbent party.
Right. So it sounds like you've got a lot of people feeling that things are slowly getting better, but not a lot of people pointing at the stimulus package and saying, thank you very much, Obama White House, which is, of course,
exactly
what they would like.
Well, and even the Obamas, I'll say for the White House, they don't say we did the stimulus and then quit, right? One of the reasons why it's hard for them to take credit for the stimulus specifically is because then they say, and by the way, look at the five things we did after that. We also did, this thing on jobs, and we also did this thing on minimum wage, or also the Health Care Act is having an effect, right? So there's all these other things that they say build on the stimulus as the foundation. It's not like we started, we passed that, and then we quit. So that's why it's hard to go back to that particular bill and say, there is our achievement, there is our spark for the recovery.
So final question for you. There are a couple of representatives leaving Congress. Gloria McLeod from California is leaving, and also Rush Holt of New Jersey. Any idea about why they're leaving and whether it signals anything other than people just kind of wanting to move on?
Rush Holt doesn't surprise me. He ran for Senate and lost, and now he's kind of bored, and there's not a whole lot of places to go up at that point once he's been in the House for a while. The McLeod one's kind of interesting. She's only been in Congress for 2 years. She's a first-termer, so she's really finishing her second year, and she's leaving to run for a county commissioner office in San Bernardino County, which it doesn't sound like a step up
right
on the political chart. I can't speak to, obviously everyone makes their own judgments here. Part of it is, in California particularly, if you are a backbench Democrat, you have no meaningful role in Congress. I mean, there's a bunch of senior Democrats ahead of you. You're in the minority party in the House of Representatives anyway. You can't really get much done. In state government, you can represent more people working for the state, you know, than you can working in Congress.
So, and we're going to have to leave it there. Paul, it was great to talk to you again. Appreciate it.
Absolutely my pleasure, Veronica. We'll talk to you.
That was Paul Singer, politics and Congress editor at USA Today.
Our guest today has a dire prediction. He says that if poaching rates continue as they are today, elephants will disappear completely from Africa by 2025.
Mike Bond joins us now. He's a novelist, war and human rights correspondent, and the author of The Last Savannah. Mike has lived and worked in many remote, war-torn regions of the world and has spent time fighting elephant poachers in Africa. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you very much. It's a delight to be here on Central Time.
Well, there's been some big news in the U.S. in the past several months having to do with the ivory trade and the destruction of this country's ivory stockpile of seized ivory. Can you catch us up on the latest?
Well, about a year ago, it became clear. I mean, it's always been clear, but it started to make international noise that the elephants were just disappearing at an astonishing rate in Africa. They're being slaughtered at an astonishing rate. And it's taken a while to galvanize this opinion, but where we stand now, because let me back up a bit, if I might. We're about 1970, we had 10 million elephants in Africa, more or less. As of today, they're down to 400,000, including both the forest elephant and the savanna elephant. And they're being killed at the rate of over 100 a day. So given the increase in the poaching rate, the 2025 date as the complete elimination of elephants in Africa seems very likely. And lately in the last few months, it's just as you were beginning to get into, we had had some movement. We've had, first of all, the European Union, 28 nations, came out with a whole series of resolutions that ivory trade and or the trade of blood ivory, if you wish, illegal ivory, is a criminal offense. They're trying to make that stick in all 28 countries now. The UN has similarly come out with a resolution basically saying the same thing, and of course the deal now is to get member countries to accept the resolution. There's been a lot of international meetings. Hillary Clinton was very strong on putting together a group of people to try to reach out to the governments of all of the African nations and get some coordination to cut back on the slaughter. And just more recently, the Obama administration has basically, through what's called an administrative action, has attempted to halt all ivory, blood ivory transactions in the United States, i.e. either importing into the United States, selling within the United States, or exporting out. And the problem with that is that it requires a diligent involvement of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in inventorying cargoes coming into the United States and going out. And that is being substantially impaired by the sequestration in the government, whereby there's cutting back of funds so that right now Fish and Wildlife has insufficient agents to do the job. So in that sense, you could argue that the Obama administration's action will not have a lot of impact.
So, Mike, we want to talk about those efforts to stop the trade and to stop poaching and who those poachers are. But let's go back to that issue of the destruction of the ivory stockpile. Why is that important? And is there any reason not to destroy all of that ivory?
It's important. It's a two-edged sword. You can look at it. I believe it's very important. It has to be emphasized. What happened in 1990, the CITES, International Agreements on Suppressing Ivory Trading, they did allow countries to keep some stocks. And so there's always been a gray line between what's a stock, what supposedly was legally culled, as if you could legally kill an elephant. And then they slowly, for financial reasons, filter that back out into the market, and the market is incredibly, right now the market, the ivory market is the hottest it's ever been. The prices in China have gone up 5,000 times, 5,000%, which is 50 times in the last 10 years. So the idea of the crushing them or the burning them is to removes them from the potential of being traded. And also, it's a statement. It's a statement that, that this is illegal. And the same way, I suppose, that you might burn, I don't know what you do with it, but you might somehow destroy a cargo of heroin.
But couldn't it be argued that by taking that stockpile out of potential circulation that you're actually making ivory that much more valuable for the poachers?
Definitely, you could argue that, but it's part of an international condemnation. And France has done it, the United States has done it, Kenya has done it, a couple of other African nations have. I believe Great Britain is about to, even China, in a kind of a publicity move, crushed or burned, I forget which, a small amount. You could argue that, but the situation is more that we just have to, the only way the elephants are going to survive is if we absolutely remove from human consciousness the idea that ivory is something that should be sold, bought, or made into something. We have to remove this option from human awareness. Otherwise, the elephants are toast.
You mentioned that the price of ivory in China was going through the roof, so obviously there's demand there. Where does the U.S. fit into that picture? How big is the demand here?
Well, the demand here is huge. We are the second largest. The United States is the second largest importer of blood ivory after China. And that's why the Obama administration's move is a very good one. As I said, it's going to be very difficult to implement because there's a whole underground market for ivory even in the United States. I've been told, I haven't checked this out, but there are more than 10,000 blood ivory sites selling ivory on Google. And that kind of thing is extremely difficult to track down and to in any way override.
What do people want ivory for?
Well, in many Asian cultures, not only China, but Thailand as well, Indochina to some degree, certainly Japan, for many, many centuries, ivory has been a cult kind of status thing. If you were wealthy and you had a certain amount of status, you proved it by purchasing ivory, which either if you were very wealthy, you would purchase an ornate ivory sculpture. And I've seen things like ivory thrones and made of hundreds, not hundreds, but many different tusks, all carved and intricately put together. And so it's a huge status symbol in these countries, again, particularly in China, to have ivory. It shows that you're wealthy and that you're kind of in touch with Chinese are very methodical about how they pursue their culture, if you wish. And what's happened over the last 20 or 30 years is, in my opinion, U.S. politicians and corporations have worked a concerted thing to remove jobs from the United States and send them to China. Chinese people, as we all know, have gotten comparatively rich, a lot of them. There's just millions of people in China who a generation ago were impoverished, and they now have millions or many hundreds of thousands of dollars all come from, or mostly from, the U.S. economy. And so that's what's fueling this enormous demand, is this incredible growth of wealth in China. And the problem is, too, that on the African end, it's now the poaching is not any longer done by a bunch of guys in a village with a couple of guns. These are either parts of some African armies that are doing it, or they're highly coordinated poachers that are connected to terrorist groups like Al-Shabaab, which is the people that are linked to Al-Qaeda, who shot up that marvelous shopping center in Nairobi a few months ago.
So, Mike, you have spent time in Africa fighting those poachers that you just talked about. What is it like on the ground working to save the elephants from those poachers?
Oh, it's terrifying. And I haven't done anywhere near as much as some guys have. But you're out there. What we did is we were out in the bush in Kenya one time. I'll give you an example. We out in the bush and you just patrol. And because the savannah is very wide, you can hear gunshots a long way off. So we're out in the bush and just patrolling, looking for vehicle tracks, anything that would give us a clue that we might have some poachers nearby. And you can hear the gunshots 4 or 5 miles away. So you leap in your Jeep and you race in that direction, 3 or 4 Jeeps with rangers who are poorly armed and making maybe $2 a day. And then you have to go into the jungle, because the savannah, what it is, as we all know, it's a mixture of grassland, rolling grassland, and forested areas. So you end up having to head into a forested or dangerous area looking for people who are waiting to shoot you. So in that regard, it's a very terrifying thing. In addition, in Africa, when you're out in the bush like that, there's so many other things that are dangerous. You could step in a little to the wrong way, and the Gabon viper bites you in the leg, and you've got a minute to live. Or there might be a hungry lioness that is waiting to pick off the person who's the most isolated from the rest of the team. So it's a very spooky thing.
We're talking right now with Mike Bond. He's a novelist and war and human rights correspondent. He's also spent time fighting poachers in Africa, as we're hearing about, and he turned that into a novel, those experiences, called The Last Savannah.
And we'd like to have you join the conversation. Do you think America has done enough to combat elephant poaching? Are you worried we could live in a world without wild elephants in Africa? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking about recent efforts by the United States to curb the ivory trade and protect endangered elephants in Africa. Mike Bond is with us now, and he wrote a novel about fighting poachers in Africa. It was based on his real-life experience there.
And you can join in. Do you think this should be a priority for the United States and other Western countries? Should we be combating elephant poaching, and how? And are you worried about what a world without wild elephants in Africa would be like? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And let's go to the phones and Alex in Stoughton. Hi, Alex.
Hi there.
Hi.
My question for Mr. Bond is how far we're willing to go in terms of removing the idea of poaching from the human consciousness. I feel like we enter into sort of dangerous territory when we're trying to, you know, make people not think about that. We almost have to start censoring scenes from classic works of literature like Moby Dick, where they capture whales in order to obtain these ivory. And, you know, in order to remove that as part of the human experience, I think would be sort of dangerous. So how far are we willing to go in that endeavor? And then what are some sort of positive ways that we can encourage people not to poach? And if there are some, why haven't they been effective in the past?
Thanks for that call, Alex. Mike, would you like to respond?
Yeah, that's a very good series of questions. And I think you're absolutely right. This is not an attempt to engineer changes in consciousness. This is, and in fact, my book, The Last Savannah, there's several passages in it involving poaching, and it write down on the ground how it really happens and what goes on and what you're left with. So I believe absolutely, and my goal is that we make these things more evident as part of what I call literature as revolution. My whole purpose is to make things known, and the idea being that if you can tell the truth, then we can change. So I think what we have to do is just make people aware that this isn't a negative thing. This is like child molestation or some other horrendous thing. It's a form of behavior that we need to alter. And in the book, the only part that we can really alter is the consciousness of whether or not a person should purchase ivory, because the people who are out there shooting the elephants on the ground, we can't reach them. It's war right now. It's like Syria. And so we're not going to be able to negotiate a change with them. We have to make all humans aware of what this terrible tragedy is. And that's why I wrote the book. I wrote The Last Savannah to put the reader actually on the ground in Africa. It's extremely vivid. I'm close to all the animals, and I bring the animals to the reader and the different tribes and languages and the histories and myths all to the reader. And so I'm trying to create such an exciting and unforgettable memory. It's as if the person had been there, and that's how I think we should change. And to the part of your question referring to what can we do, one of the best things to do is to simply join the World Wildlife Fund. They have done an absolutely amazing job. They're trying to internationalize and broadcast this issue. And they have folks in Africa, like I was, who are risking their lives on a daily basis trying to put a stop to this.
Mike, I want to ask you, you mentioned that you wanted to tell people the truth, that what really happened on the ground when an elephant is slaughtered. And it might be difficult to hear, you know, sitting here removed so far from Africa and what you saw, but I wonder if you could tell us what does happen.
Well, what happens is, in some cases now, the poachers, particularly those with military regimes that are doing part of the poaching, they are now locating elephants sometimes by air. And because the elephants, as I remember when I was young, that a group of elephants, a herd of elephants, could be 3 miles wide and 10 miles long, and they would be migrating down from the mountains in north central Kenya down toward the wetter southern part of Kenya, and it was huge. And now there are little outposts of elephants hidden in the bush wherever they can, terrified of the guns. So it's getting harder and harder to find them because there's fewer and fewer. But so they're up there. They, one way or the other, these guys track down a bunch of elephants, and usually it's a small herd, again, for the reasons I said. And they simply go in, and the first thing they do is they try to shoot all the big elephants so that they're, so the big ones don't represent a danger. And they're usually using AK-47, so it means a number of bullets. Sometimes a whole magazine goes into one elephant. It takes a long time for an elephant to die in great pain from being shot with an AK-47. And then they mop up, i.e. they kill the smaller elephants, may not even have any tusks, but they'll even kill a baby because the baby is standing by its mother crying, not understanding why the mother is dead. So it's and then they just go in with a chainsaw or with an axe, and they chop off the tusks and throw them in the back of a pickup truck, and off they go. And it goes from there. The tusks go to a village where they're trucked eventually to a port, where they're put in a big container that's labeled furniture or pineapples or something, and off they go to China.
Yeah, that is incredibly hard to hear, but thank you for telling us what you saw.
And you said that if current poaching rates continue, you predict an Africa without elephants by 2025. That's really pretty devastating and very close time-wise. Do you think there's any way at this point that we can avoid a future like that?
I think there's two really important things we could do. And one is that the developed nations, which have in general more organized armed forces, there needs to be an international armed force that is sent to Africa with the whole purpose of fighting the poachers. Could be a United Nations force, fighting the poachers and interdicting the transport of blood ivory. That would be one thing. We need boots on the ground. And I can think of, I have many friends in the U.S. Marines, and every single one of them says that that would be the best training that young Marines could have, is to be out there on the ground hunting down the poachers. I mean, it's war. It's a guerrilla war. And so that's one thing. And the second thing I think is really important, isn't being done yet, isn't even being talked about, but should be done, is some kind of a boycott on Chinese goods. The Chinese have so completely devastated our economy, and they are the major environmental criminal, if you wish. They pollute everything. They pollute the air. They pollute the waters. They overfish everywhere. They have absolutely no environmental consciousness. And so as far as the Chinese government is concerned, they've made a couple of window dressing moves, but they're not doing anything significant to even advertise that blood ivory is got to be stopped. A lot of the Chinese people think that tusks fall off elephants as they do off a deer, for instance, and as an antler falls off a deer. So the second really important thing that could be done is a worldwide or at least a U.S. boycott on Chinese goods.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got a lot of folks waiting to talk to you, and go to Larry in Kewaskum. Hi, Larry.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, I'm a piano technician, and I have bags of ivory from keytops that I've recovered with plastic. And I have a grand piano in my living room with an absolutely perfect ivory keyboard. It was built in 1938. Is this going to endanger the elephant? I mean, I don't know if this ivory is worth anything, but I'm a member of the Sierra Club, so I don't want to, you know, sell this ivory to for.
Yeah, this is a good point. It's
all
a
right,
seriously
thanks,
good point, Larry. My wife is a pianist also, and we have several pianos with ivory keys. I never asked her whether there's a difference in playing it between the ivory and the plastic. Larry, what do you feel about that?
Oh, there definitely is a difference. Yes, it wicks away the
perspiration.
You know,
Yeah. Well, I have no knowledge as to how much those keys that you have, the extra ones, might be worth. But at this point, as I understand the Obama administration's action, it's now illegal for you to try to sell those.
Okay. So he should, what, hand them over to the government?
I'd say just keep them. Keep them, you know,
keep
because
them.
Sooner or later they're going to become valuable to replace on other old pianos. I mean, most of the new pianos, I believe, are being manufactured without ivory keys. Am I correct about that, Larry?
Well, that's my question. If ivory is going to be so desirable for, let's say, antique pianos, wouldn't that increase the reason for elephants to be slaughtered?
Right, so Larry's not wanting to create demand there. And I want to stop there so we can have a last question with you, Mike. I just want to, if you wanted to urge people to care about this, I wonder if you could leave us with one of the elephants, a story about one of the elephants you got close to in our last 30 seconds here.
Okay, well, you just go to the book for lots of elephant stories, The Last Savannah, or my website, MikeBondBooks.com, has lots of elephant stories. But one of the nicest ones we remember is just being in camp at night, my wife and I and the three kids, under mosquito nets on cots, and a whole herd of elephants moving through the camp and moving right around our cots and sometimes sticking out their trunks to give us a sniff. It was a lovely feeling of connection.
Well, Mike, thank you so much for joining us and for talking about this today.
Well, thank you for covering this. It's a really important issue, and it's typical of WPR to be involved with this. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Appreciate that. Mike Bond is a novelist, a war and human rights correspondent, and a human rights activist. He's the author of the new novel, The Last Savannah. It's drawn from his real-life experiences fighting poachers in Africa.